Hello, everyone. Content warnings for this episode include a discussion of the Spanish Civil War, including some of the atrocities that happened as part of that. Just so all of you know, we were joined by a special guest, Abel Arroyo, who is a pastor and has been on this podcast a few times. Sadly, his internet cut out because of a power outage in his neighborhood towards the end of recording. So we did our best to finish the episode without them. And we are super sad and bummed that we didn't get to hear their rating, but definitely check out their social media and things to find them. You can find links for all that in the show notes. Without further ado, here is our episode on Devil's Backbone. Greetings, everyone. You're listening to Horror Nerds at Church, a ridiculously queer podcast where we take a deep dive into a horror film and talk about how it connects to queerness, religion, theology, all those good things. My name is Pace, and I am the cistern that nobody is getting ill from, I guess, which I'm surprised that they're not getting ill from if they're using that as drinking water, so for reasons.
I have been wondering, and I'm Pastor Emily, and I am the hollow leg filled with gold, weighing a little extra.
Hi, my name is Abel Arroyo, and I am the kid who keeps splattering blood on the ceiling.
I love So, listeners, we are joined again for I guess this is, I want to say, third time, fourth time, I don't know, somewhere in there, by Pastor Abel. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself in case our listeners haven't figured out who you are thus far?
Well, who am I right now? That's a wonderful question. Right now, I am wearing the hat of assistant to the Bishop for Faith Formation in Southwest California Synod. I'm also like their theologian. Also restarting a project that kind of had to stop about a year ago, the Chaotic Bisexual Text Study. So very excited about getting back in the groove of like recording and stuff, and good things. Live in Phoenix, Arizona, even though I work with Southwest California, because I can do all things through Christ who strengthens
I love it. I love it. I was hoping we'd get tea on Chaotic Bisexual Podcast because I've been missing y'all.
Oh,
Oh,
it was
life.
just like, oh, real life is catching up with us. We need to take a break, or we're gonna lower the standards that weren't really high to start with. So, like, we can't go any lower than that already. So, might as well take a
It.
break, gather
Fair,
ourselves,
fair.
and.
I feel that. I feel that a lot.
I don't know if we have any announcements right now. If you haven't seen our
That is
Star
a good one.
Wars announcement,
This is the
then.
first episode since that announcement, I think, right?
Yes.
We had an announcement of our new Revenge of the Sixth season
The
of
puns are killing
Horror Nerds at Church. It
me.
the announcement was delightfully fun, but also the beginning video was spectacular. So we'll link to it and folks can go check it out in the show notes. But the long and short of it is a whole bunch of Star Wars and aliens and predators and things.
All of that for our upcoming season six. But we're still in season five, which is why we are joined by Pastor Abel to talk about this weird ghost movie. Before we get into it, though, I know you've told us a real life church horror story on a past episode, but do you have another one you can share with us? I'm sure you have plenty, an abundance
Who
of
are you
loaves and
asking?
fishes. You.
Me? Okay. So my Del Toro story is like he's a pretty wholesome guy. So like it to me is like super fascinating that he's into like this like really like psychological horror pieces that he's been doing. Like I was revisiting like his first movie that apparently was a bust, but I loved it, Chronos. Right. Where the main, like, not the main character, but like the main monster spirit is like a Christ with three arms. Just like, what a grand guy, honestly. Like, he has such an eye and mind for reimagining, subverting, if you will, like themes of like horror into something that a lot of people can relate to.
Have you seen Cabinet of Curiosities?
Not yet.
This episode. Me neither. It is so up there though, because I have to see it soon. Just life.
The random creeping in the background is our ice truck that drives by.
It's fitting for our podcast.
Delightful. Delightful. Yes.
Random.
Just sharing. You were like, yeah. What?
So only our Patreon subscribers or real true Nightmare on Elm Street fans, hardcore fans know this, but in the Freddy's Nightmares TV show, which we covered on Patreon last season, we learned that from that show that Freddy used to use an ice cream truck to lure people to. So I feel like the ice cream truck is especially creepy.
Yeah, I do feel like anytime there's an ice cream truck in a movie that is like, maybe this is scary, I'm gonna think it's creepy.
See, when I hear ice cream truck, I'm like, oh, someone's moving drugs. Like, it has nothing to do with like the creepiness, and it's more like, oh, these are the streets.
No,
that works.
I love it. Well, I guess we can get into this fun movie. So, when was the first time you have seen this movie, Pastor Abel?
Devil's Backbone. That is from 91.
Woo. 2001.
2001, not 91. So where was I? Because that's the same year Fellowship of the Ring came out.
Oh, thank you for giving me something that I would have like a reference point for.
Right. No, because like I remember everyone was about Fellowship of the Ring because of the special effects and like everything that they were doing. You know, gigantic like cast. And then there's Devil's Backbone. With, like, a minuscule budget.
Yeah.
You know, trying to be, like, Lord of the Rings. Which didn't happen, but, you know, honorable mention.
It's true. Yeah.
So, if that's 2001, that was, like, my first year of living in the United States, I think.
Oh, okay. I didn't see it until this year because, as is apparently usual for our podcast, I saw it for the first time for this episode. Although I have now seen it twice. So feel like everybody can take a drink and also not. Now I've seen it twice. But both were for this episode.
Yeah. So. You don't have to take a drink for me though, because this movie came out after I was 12. So no worries there. I saw it for the first time when I was in college, which was like 2004 to 2008. So a few years after it came out. I remember watching it at a recommendation of a friend who's also into horror movies, who said, you've got to see this. It's one of the scariest horror movies ever made. Lived up to that reputation for me that time I watched it. Rewatching it again recently, I don't know if it fully lives up to one of the scariest movies ever made, but it certainly still has some like stunning visuals that stick with me and have stuck with me since I first saw it. So a little bit of background, though, for this movie. This movie was the first full-length feature that Guillermo del Toro wrote, although it did not come out, as Abel mentioned before, it, like Cronus and a few of his other films came out. But this was in his mind that whole time. It was originally set in Mexico, and it was named after the Devil's Backbone mountain range there. And it was originally going to be set in the Mexican Revolution. But
Did they change it?
I don't know.
Because it feels... I'm not surprised that it was originally set.
But when in changing it, though, he kept the Devil's Backbone title, but instead it now refers to the Limbo Juice, which is infants with spinal bifida, as shown in the film. So it's a little weird there. And I wonder if the reason he changed it to the Spanish Civil War is because of the background of that and the religious and socio-political conflicts there perhaps could be tied into the story in a way that I think they were, which we can get into our deep dive. So. That's my guess, but I don't know.
Yeah.
I have thoughts about that, but I don't know if this is the time or later is the time.
Now is always the time.
So here's the thing. Like, for me, keeping it in Mexico wouldn't have made as much sense because, like, the setting is also part of, like, the setting is a character.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm thinking, like, as a Latin American person, right? Like, Mexico and setting it in Mexico is not going to be foreign, is not going to be mm-hmm. out there, is not going to be threatening. But for most Latin Americans, like, if you say Spain, we all have feelings about Spain and how that whole thing came down, right? So,
right.
Like, in doing so, I think that it strengthens that the monster that isn't a monster and the people who are monsters, kind of like right. his thing, right? Mm-hmm. The thing he's done since the very beginning.
Yeah. Yep.
That makes sense.
I guess we can go through the film. I don't have really many notes here. It's one of those films that, like, it's just, I guess I can say that to start off the conversation that it's just so visually compelling, as are many of his films, even like Pacific Rim, I will say. But like, I love just the ghost character with the trail of blood or the unsuspicious bomb, as somebody has referenced in their name for a recording and stuff like that. Like, that's just in like just these visually striking images. I've never seen a more creepily depicted ghost before or after this movie than just one with like the blood that is like clearly like coming out as if it's underwater, and yet he's not underwater in the scenes he appears as a ghost. So
yeah, I was really excited that the movie was in Spanish, and then as happens with a lot of subtitles, my eyes always go to the subtitles to read them, and there was no way to turn off the English subtitles or to switch them to Spanish. And so it was harder for me to immerse myself in the movie, I think, because I had both Spanish and English.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, then the second time watching it, because I had already, like, in notes and stuff, I was just watching it for refreshing. I listened more than I watched. And so it was just really interesting to just let it be a Spanish movie and not a movie with English subtitles, if that makes sense. So
what do you mean by that?
I guess it's just like the way that I watch movies when there are subtitles, my eyes always go to reading the subtitles. And so if there's a movie in a language I understand, like Spanish, and the subtitles are in English, my brain, because I'm seeing the words in English, my brain still tries to make sense of it in English, as opposed to watching the movie in Spanish and letting my brain absorb it in Spanish and understand it in Spanish.
Okay. That's a skill. Like, good for you for trying, but that's a skill that develops, definitely. Yeah.
So, but I really appreciated, especially the, like, because I was watching it during the day, because that's how I watch scary movies, the big contrast, like the dark, dark scenes and the bright daylight of the daytime scenes and stuff, and the way that light was used as well as the Santi.
I thought there were so many, like, themes of just, like, you know, urban legends and common stories from Latin America that were very present in the film, that I wonder if they made it through, you know, like, or if they just get lost in translation. For example, like, the whole thing about, like, where is this treasure? Like, that is a thing that every, like, old Latin American family has heard at some point, like, oh, there is treasure in this lot, there is treasure in this wall, like, in this house somewhere, in this 400-year-old house, like, there's there's loot. And I'm like, oh, so this is a story, okay, got it, like, it's all had.
Yeah.
And then the whole thing with the bomb, I thought it was fascinating, because there is a story that ties to the bombs that didn't detonate, that fell onto villages and whatever, but didn't detonate. And that was because the people manufacturing the bombs during the Spanish Civil War were like, okay, yes, we're opposing like, politically we're opposing, but we, like, we're not killing our own.
Mm.
So throughout Spain, there are stories of bombs falling onto, like, churches and cathedrals and whatever, and not detonating. And of course, people attribute that to, like, some kind of miracle, so there's an extra sanctuary because the bomb didn't detonate. And then when people actually, and this is more of a legend, but, like, whenever they got to dismantling the bombs, there were allegedly always find, like, a note saying, like, you know, you're not the ones we're supposed to be attacking, to the effect of that. So I thought it was really cool that those little details were added onto the story as, like, landscape. Like, it made it feel very familiar.
Yeah. I do not know much about the Spanish Civil War. So I've heard of, like, that happening in different wars, like, mostly World War II, but...
And Spanish Civil War is kind of part of World War II, kind of its own thing. It's all kind of wrapped in there, which you can get into a deep dive. But anything else with there's so much in this movie, I don't even know where to unpack it besides just in the deep dive, because everything I feel like in this has so much meaning. But I'd love to hear more from you all about it before I get into a deep dive, if you have anything.
I think I'm good.
Okay. This is probably our shortest rolling through a film, but I think it's because we all just want to get to the deep dive because there's so much good stuff here. So I can just start by talking about the background of the film, since you about it, I agree with you 100% that the setting is kind of in and of itself a character. And so the Spanish Civil War, for those who don't know, was from 1936 to 1939. Nationalists were made up of monarchists, and fascist groups were first seen the Republicans, which was the government in place at the time the war started, and socialist anarchist groups that were aligning themselves with that. It began with a partially failed coup in 1936 by leaders of the Spanish Republican Armed Forces trying to take out the left and center-left government. Both sides of the war participated in mass executions and war crimes, so unsurprisingly, the nationalists are the guiltier party of the two, especially because of their alliance with fascists and stuff. The war resulted in Francisco Franco and his nationalist forces winning, and he became dictator of Spain from 1939 to 1945. He also instituted the Catholic Church as the official church, and kind of like Catholic rule, and then he was hoping to kind of restart Spanish's colonial empire, but that was kind of slowly falling apart as the world at large was slowly, the colonial aspects of the world at large were slowly transitioning to post-colonial, whatever that is. There were also the lost children of Francoism, as many as 300,000 kids, mostly of Republican parentage, who were child trafficked throughout the early part and the immediate aftermath of the war. And I feel like that also kind of the setting with this Republican-owned orphanage trying to look after some of the children. And then the Spanish transition to democracy followed the death of Francisco Franco in 75, but as is the case in much of Europe and in the United States, fascist political tensions are rising again, so yikes. But all of that to say that this movie really kind of plays upon the war as a overall historical setting for the film, but then also the way that plays out in the character relationships with one another and things like that. And also just the way that war, no matter which side you were on, just the ways affect everyone.
Yeah, I think particularly for the kids who have not done anything, like their parents are involved in some way, and then you get these kids who are from throughout the area brought to this one spot, be kept at least for while the war is happening, and then the end of the movie is not them like going home safely or any of that. It is them setting out to walk and hopefully make it for the like 24-hour walk to town with like, and who knows what they'll find there.
But that's the monster, right? Like for me, that's why Del Toro's movies are good, quite frankly, because you like, it's never who you think it's going to be. You know, it's never who you think it's going to be. And then you have this big character throughout his war. And how it's never an event, but it's always a reality. Like, that is reality for the characters. That is reality for the movie. It's not just something that's going to happen and end. Because for most people, they don't know that. So I really appreciate that kind of detail of like, yeah, this is a historical moment. However, these are the realities of life, and they should be horrifying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's also like specifically set in 1939, the last year of the war. And at this point, the Republican forces are kind of losing. And so there's also a desperation in there with like the last-ditch effort to get the gold to the Republican forces to protect the children who are there. Like, I feel like there's just this general sense of foreboding of impending doom, that the war is gearing up for its final push and we probably won't survive this. So what can we do in the meantime? Sort of feel that a lot of the characters I feel like are experiencing.
And we get like the pushes towards that with when the doctor is in town selling teas, everything shot, and they are at the doorstep.
And then also, like we mentioned, the ending, like even if the kids do survive to the town, like
there's a world and they're walking, like if we put it in context, right? Yeah. They are walking into a fascist regime.
Exactly. Yep. Yeah. Exactly. It's not like Sound of Music where they cross the Alps and make it into
not at all.
Fascism. No, they are walking directly into fascism.
Yeah. And I think like that the lines, the two lines about ghosts that stuck out to me in the movie were, one was when Carmen says, "Sometimes I think we are the ghosts," but then the other is the, like, at the very end, the kind of narration that's also the ghost conversation of like a ghost being a tragedy to repeat itself, a moment of pain suspended in time, and like that. And so then looking at kids literally walking off into fascist regime, and then, I mean, this came out in 2001, but I imagine like if it had come out this year or last year, there'd be this, and I think in 2001 there was that in a different sense, particularly, I don't know, I imagine it came out before 9/11, but the way that 9/11 changes towards fascism as well, but that like it is, this fascism is a tragedy doomed to repeat itself because we are not actually addressing fascism, and like we're not actually stopping fascism, we're just like trying to skirt around it, and so then it just becomes this thing repeats over and over again.
But on the other hand, like people have to survive. You know, not everyone is a fighter, and I think that in this movie, right, like expecting the kids to do anything other than survive, that would be putting us in like the place of the monster.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. I agree. I think I was looking at it more from like my perspective as an adult and being like, this is what the kids are walking into then, and this is what the kids are walking into now, and how do we, for those of us who are adults, how do we change it so that the kids are not walking into the then again year after year?
I think kind of how the doctor, what was the doctor's name again? Dr. Cesare's, that final narration he has as a ghost is so poignant, is because we are doomed to repeat this again. So like you're saying, Emily, and about like what kind of warnings can we heed from this in any sort of future attempts? Or is it this kind of like nihilistic ending of like, no matter what, things are going to get shitty again, and it's just like, that's just a cycle that we just have to survive, and I'm not sure there is a good answer for the film. I think the film purposely leaves it ambiguous, but living through the past few years,
I don't think it's that ambiguous though. Like, okay, sometimes here's my thing, like there is this obsession with like Western storytelling where by the end of the story, you have to have it neatly packed and, you know, with a bow, and you get your ending, and it's usually a happy ending. But like, there is no particular reason why stories have to handhold like the outcome, you know, like sometimes, hey, you survived this one thing. That's a great ending. Like kids survive.
Yeah.
10 out of 10. What happens next? Who knows? But like, as far as this story, it's very clear they survive.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess what I'm trying to say by ambiguous is more what the ghost doctor is trying to say, I feel like is purposefully an ambiguous sort of, you have seen this story, you have witnessed these events. Now, what you learn from this is up to you, as opposed to, like you're saying, handholding us through some sort of moral, or this is where the story is going.
This is what this means. Like, yes, exactly. It really allows you to, and that's because Del Toro is Latin American. Like he's not bound by those conventions.
Yeah.
I struggle a lot with that with preaching, actually, because I realize that I don't handhold my congregation. Like I preach, and I'm like, you can draw your own conclusions, and then some people refuse and they don't like it because they enjoy being told what to think. So you can imagine how much like I related to that. He's not telling us like this is good, this is bad, it just is, and they get to live through it.
I love it.
And I think now you have me thinking about my own preaching, and I've had a couple of sermons like that, especially lately, where it's just like there's only so many ways to tell you that God loves you and also those other people that you might not love, and that the world's on fire. And so like just like that space of like name where we are at and just being like, you know what? You get to make that decision. You get to decide what this means. But like you get to decide what this means for you as individuals, as a congregation, for the community you're in. Like you at some point have to take on the agency to not, as you were saying about, to not be spoon-fed and handheld, like no hand-holding, no spoon-feeding, like you're grown-ass adults, like take responsibility for.
Yeah, you survive, you're alive, like come on, get, you know, to the next thing, even if it's fascism, like how are you going to survive this?
Yeah.
Since we're talking about preaching, I can relate to when the first time we viewed this, I was preparing to preach on Doubting Thomas, and so I watched it with that kind of text in my mind, and just how, and I feel like the woundedness of the ghost, it was very compelling to me, and the touching of the blood and seeing that the blood is real, is what the, and how Carlos, when he touches, but like Carlos, one of the interesting things about him is he doesn't seem to experience fear with the ghost very much at all. A little bit of alarm the first time, but that's about it. And so just that in the touching of the ghost, in the touching of the ghost's blood, and the leaving behind of the blood on the stone and things, that Carlos's reaction isn't fear for in any of that, but it's kind of like belief that there's this story here that I need to participate in, that I need to figure out what happened.
One of the things that I have discovered in the course of this ghost series is that I actually really like ghosts, and they're not particularly scaring me necessarily. Mostly because ghost stories are unresolved stories, right? And we get that something happened, and so Santi can't kind of dissipate, be at rest, be at peace, any of that, until that gets resolved capacity. And then in resolving it, there's another ghost that's created. I'm enjoying this, but I do think Santi is particularly, I really like the character of Santi. My first reaction to him was that he looks like a slightly creepier version of Miguel from Coco when he's like slowly turning into the skeleton. But there's this like Santiago, St. James, like the holiness that is inherent in his name, and also the like, what they call him as the ghost is El Cuspid, the one who sighs. And talking about like those conditions and the like that space, that last breath leaving, or the space of like in Romans with sighs too deep for words to express, and that kind of just that connection to like the holiness of even maybe especially in death, that there is a holiness to Santi's life that didn't get to be lived out in life. He was killed at such a young age, but that doesn't take from that holiness. I don't know if that actually makes any sense.
Don't need to hand hold us through making sense of it. God damn. Yama del Toro. This is our first one of his movies we're covering on the podcast. No, that's not true. We covered, it was on Patreon, but we covered Blade 2 on Patreon as a movie commentary. That train wreck of a movie. He tried. It was Marvel. They didn't know what they're doing.
I did not make that connection between those two movies.
He did a weird like string of superhero movies in the 2000s. Blade 2 and then Hellboy 2, which is still really good. I love Hellboy 2 if you haven't seen it. The first Hellboy sucks and the new one kind of sucks, but Hellboy 2 is where it's at.
I was ready for him to make the leap into video games and that got canceled. Ooh. That was very disappointing.
Right.
And it was like the perfect franchise for him too, because he was going to collaborate with, I don't remember the director's name, on a sequel for Silent Hill. And right. Silent Hill's a horror video game franchise, like Ooh. Immersive. It's really good. Mm-hmm. It can get a little cheesy, like if you get into like the metaphysics of it, but mm-hmm. like the atmosphere creation is spot on in every single one of those games. And to bring Guillermo del Toro as someone who is so good at creating atmosphere would have been amazing.
Yeah. But they do... I was devastated by that too, because wasn't there like a full trailer, I think, was
even there is released, a There was a playable so trailer, yes. That's what
it is, yes. But now they have Silent Hill 2 remake that they just announced, which I'm kind of digging for. It's about time they brought like a... What do they call it? AAA game title back to the Silent Hill franchise has been
doing, yes,
but still I mourn the possibility of what could have been with Guillermo del Toro.
Yeah, for real. Helm. And here's my thing about like Silent Hill type games, like they get so hung up into like the satanic imagery that it's just silly. You know, it's like one of those things like, okay, this is like the seventh pentagram that I've seen on the floor. At some point, they lose their edge. You know what I mean? Like, oh, this is another kind of blood. It's not the red kind. Thank you. A for effort. Like,
yeah. It's true. It's true. Since we're kind of tangenting anyway, and I'm all for it. What's your favorite Guillermo del Toro film, Abel?
Ooh, my favorite. I just saw the new Pinocchio.
Ooh. I haven't seen it yet.
Good lord, it's so good.
I'm kind of scared to see it because I've heard so many good things that I'm worried that I'm gonna be let down. But who am I kidding? It's Guillermo del Toro. I'm not gonna be let down.
Listen, no, it's like it's stop motion, which is something he's wanted to do since like the beginning of his career. And because there wasn't like the capacity to do it in Mexico, instead of going abroad, he took the time to train people and open an academy for people to learn stop motion in Mexico. So the whole process took 13 years because he took the time to like educate and open like a field of work in Mexican filmmaking. Like, this is just a fascinating dude. Like, I love him.
I kind of love... I have a soft spot for The Shape of Water just because of that one moment when the character's describing how sex works with it, and I just love that they don't shy away from that. Just depict that whole little hand motion she does to...
Yep.
To explain how his image, how his stuff unfolds and comes out to play. So it's like, cool. And so I guess that's like the monster fucker in me who likes Shape of Water, but it's real.
That's your inner furry being like, I feel tended to.
Right. Or scaly, I guess, because it's a fish.
You're right. It's a scaly. Yeah. You are seeing your name.
Mm-hmm. I feel so named in that movie. Emily, I would ask you if you have a favorite, but you don't know directors well, so.
I know. I don't.
I know what would have been your favorite had he followed through and actually directed it would have been the Hobbit films when he was the original director for those before he backed out. Peter Jackson took over kind of at the end.
That would have been really cool. He probably would have, I don't know, maybe he wouldn't have, but there's a lot of Peter Jackson intentional inconsistencies with between Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit that I was just like, it's not that hard to make freeze and turn to stone in the same shape that they already are found later, turn to stone in. But I do think there's so much of the Lord of the Rings and Hobbit stories that are deeply environmental and like ambient, like creating that sort of environment in these that would have been really.
He was pretty far in production too when he stepped out. I think it was just because a lot of it, I feel like, was the war. Do you remember this about? I feel like a lot of it was like Time Warner Company just being very like hands on with wanting to turn it from two films into a trilogy and stuff to make more money. And I think that's why he stepped away.
I mean, and The Hobbit is not a particularly long book anyway.
Exactly.
Yep. I was saying, how are they making this into a trilogy?
The first time I saw the first movie in theaters, the first Hobbit movie of the trilogy in theaters, and I was like, cool, I'm going to go see The Hobbit. And I had not gotten the message that it was the first third of the whole thing. And so then when I came out, I was like, this is ridiculous. The entire Lord of the Rings was three, and you're going to make The Hobbit into three itself?
Right.
So then I like did not go see the rest of them in theaters. Like, no, you don't get all of that money for them.
Pace, is there any movie that you would be like, I want Guillermo del Toro to direct this movie? Past or present?
You probably can guess my answer because we've talked about this so many fucking times. I want what he originally had intended to do before he couldn't and made Pacific Rim instead. For him to do a Neon Genesis Evangelion live action adaptation.
He would be perfect for that. He would be perfect for that. Right.
Oh my god. 100%.
You just have to agree. Say yes.
Totally. Yeah. Me too, all the time. Do you have a movie, Abel?
Honestly, I would like to see his take on something like Beetlejuice.
That would be so much better if he did it than Tim Burton's
version. Right?
That would be so much better. We watched Beetlejuice for a movie commentary for
this March. March. I think
for our Patreon subscribers, and yeah, that would be so better.
The humor would be so different, and I would appreciate that. Honestly, like, and nothing against the original movie. Like, it's a product of its time. It's funny, a lot of like that kind of humor, but like a little like more sinister humor, I feel goes well with Beetlejuice.
That would have been.
Have you seen Pan's Labyrinth, Emily?
I think so, but like not really at all. And
okay, so that would probably be a good one to cover in Horror Nerds at Church one of these days.
It's very similar to The Devil's Backbone. When like not like the story, but the setting and the feel of it. Like, it has a very similar feel to it.
And I guess that's a good segue. Look at me trying to transition. I'm so proud of myself. But that's kind of a good segue into another thing I want to talk about in the deep dive, which is the theme of innocence that plays out, especially, like, Carlos. And just the boys in general, but, like, Carlos especially, just this kind of, like, level of innocence and intentional unawareness with the conflict unfolding around them, and to the point of like playing with snails, and that whole like scene of that shows up again a few times, and playing around a bomb as the bomb was not still potentially dangerous, but instead it was just like a toy or something or part of the setting. So I love that there's that intentionality about the innocence, and I think that also goes into why Carlos wasn't scared of Santi when he first encountered him either. Alarmed, I would say, but not scared, because the innocence, you don't know you're so afraid.
Also, that's a child who's been living through a civil war. That cannot be the first dead kid he's seen.
Right.
You know what I mean? So, like, at some point, you just get desensitized.
I mean, that's a lot of today has been that too. Like there have been like 22 mass shootings in the last week.
Oh, and, Jesus Christ, yeah.
Right, but like, they don't even make the news anymore. Right. Unless there's a big enough body count. And it's just like so hard to fathom. Yeah, the desensitization of all of that death.
But yeah, at some point, like, I can't imagine how someone's like, oh yeah, there's another body there. You know, and then wondering like, oh, he moved. He's not dead. He looks dead, but he's not dead.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that innocence and that curiosity, like, yeah. Goes a long way. And again, with the themes of, like, humanizing the other,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, ultimately, humanizing the other is what allows our main character to survive. And, like, if that isn't, like, if that doesn't preach today, you know what I mean? Like,
right.
Like, humanize the other, we might make it through.
Possibly. Hopefully.
I think also the like innocence that happens that kind of connects the kids with, I forget which kid, but the kid who like has a crush on Jeetha. And so he gives her, I want to say it's from like a cigar, but it might be from something else. But, and then she wears a ring in her hand. And like that particular innocence from the kid, but also the like intentional naivete, I would say, on the part of Jeetha that like she is choosing to like value this piece of paper wrapped in her finger to the extent that like she continues to value the kids even as she's like walking into the like trying to walk to the town and get confronted by Jacinto and is like, no te tengo miedo, I'm not afraid of you, like, and that she just keeps repeating it of like knowing that like she knows the second she sees the car, but that she doesn't have to go. She doesn't have to be killed on his turn. Say in that case of, no, I know the goodness of the purpose. I know the bigger picture. Any of those things to her saying, I'm not afraid of you.
Anything else for a deep dive?
Nothing that comes to mind, yeah. But yeah.
Awesome. Then for our ghost lore, anything new we learned here? I just want to repeat that quote that you mentioned earlier because it's such a good quote to describe ghosts. A ghost is a tragedy doomed to repeat itself. Moment of pain suspended in time. A nice way to talk about the unfinished business or the end yet something that liminality ghosts exist into. Quote a big PhD word, that kind of.
Also, ghosts can teleport themselves, but they can't get into a closed door. That, I was just like, really now? Really?
Mm-hmm.
How convenient for this plot.
Yeah. I do love, though, the ghost being a part of the revenge Santi mm-hmm. gets against Jacinto, yeah. And then also kind of the doctor becoming a, like, ghost, but, like, almost in a watching or
like a
guardian kind of way. I like those aspects to ghost personalities, too.
And the fact that that, like, puts the doctor's, like, how do I say this? The doctor's, like, resolving his own stuff becomes secondary.
Yeah.
You know, if we're taking this idea of, like, this is unresolved, unfinished business, and the ghosts are prioritizing, like, finishing their business so they can move on. Like, there's something really beautiful about a ghost who says, like, yeah, I can wait. Like, there's people who might need more support.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for sure.
And that in some ways that be like why and how, like, that is in some ways that to become a ghost, that like his job's not done caring for these, protecting these, watching over them, he remains, and we don't realize that at first until like walks by and unlocks the door for the kid.
But I also think it's a really nice reversal, because in ghost stories, in monster stories, we always get this like immortal evil, right? Like like Jason keeps coming back and back and back and keeps killing people and stuff. And there's like a doctor who's like, yeah, but love also is immortal.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Bringing some First Corinthians here to this story.
Ew.
I love it. I love that was your response. Honestly, same. I'm not a Bible person, which is fun for Emily because their pastor said they're more Bible person than I am. But
amazing. Listen, I'm a pastor too. I know, I'm just like
Abel's also a pastor. Like...
Yeah. But yeah. I don't know. Sometimes it's like we can be more than just pastors. You know what I mean? Like, you get to be people, so not everything has to go back to the Bible.
Yes. Also, I'm much more, like, interested in the sacraments than... Which we didn't even get to, like, the...
Oh, yeah, there's some... We talked a lot about in our changeling, though, so I guess we don't need to say much new, because that was a very baptismal-heavy story in that one. I just still am kind of grossed out that there's a dead body rotting in that cistern for however long, and the kids presumably were getting their drinking water and bathing water and stuff out of that.
Yeah. I'm surprised they didn't get sick.
Right. Maybe they don't die from fascism. Maybe they die from dysentery on the way.
That's an image to put in our heads. Thanks, Face.
Oh my god. Oh.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh. Okay, so out of 10 proton packs, since this is our Ghostbuster season, out of 10 proton packs, what would you rate this film? And do you have a favorite kill and or ghost? We usually start with our guests, but if you need time to think, that's okay.
Abel looks frozen
to me. Abel does look frozen to me. Oh, power went out.
Oh, that?
So then, out of 10 proton packs, Emily, how would you rate this film? And do you have a favorite kill?
Yeah, okay. I liked it. I am partial to movies where I get to, so that, like, default sets me up well for it. But I really liked the conversation, and I really liked Guillermo del Toro, like, took on the movie. So I think I am going to an 8.5.
Nice. I like it. Do you have a favorite kill / ghost / whatever?
Yeah. There's only two ghosts and I like them both for different reasons, but my favorite kill is probably obvious Jacinto, because he literally drowns because the gold weighs him down.
Right. This hasn't been a very kill heavy season, surprisingly, given that we're covering ghosts. We would think there'd be a lot of deaths in ghost films, but not really. But
it mostly happened off screen before the thing.
True. Jacinto's death is pretty good. I'll agree with that. And both ghosts I like too, but nothing gets past that twist when you realize that the doctor's been a ghost for however long. Like, I just love that
moment. Yeah. That was a big...
So, I thought I'd rate this. I'll say 8.5 as well.
All right.
For a long time, one of the scariest... I'll change it. I'm going to say a 9 because it really is still one of the eeriest settings for a movie. And just love how the mystery unfolds, even if it doesn't quite scare me like it did the first watches in the dark by myself in college. I still love it. Still very good. So, yeah. 9 out of 10. One of the best... movies we've covered on the podcast, also top 10 for me so far.
Nice.
Yeah. Did you jump at all?
I don't think so. Let me double check my note.
Okay.
I don't even know where I put my note.
I don't recall, since we watched this together the first time, I do not recall you saying you jumped at all. Because usually you'll text me if you jump.
I don't think I jumped. There was a moment when I was rewatching today. I was like, I could have jumped at this point. But yeah, I don't think I jumped. Okay. We'll leave it at 0 jump scares. Eventually we'll get jump scares that aren't...
And since we lost Abel, this will be where we insert a where to find the guest.
Mm-hmm. If nothing else, the chaotic bisexual text study.
Right. So good. Love that. Tied with Nerds at Church as my favorite lectionary-based podcast.
Yes.
And then our next movie is Ghostbusters, the remake / 2016 / Ghostbusters Into the Call /
and the best Ghostbusters,
according to Emily. Yes. And with special guest Brooke McClain. Really excited for that one.
Yeah. We already recorded it, so I already know it's awesome.
Yes. listen to it to see why Emily thinks it's the best Ghostbusters, even though they have one yet to see.
It's true. It's true. But Pace does not dispute. Like, you're not arguing for the fourth one being the... So, I feel pretty solid one.
I mean, I don't know. I haven't said one way. I'm trying to leave the fourth one up for you to make up your own mind about since you have not seen it. Mm. I feel like the first two are so iconic that you have interacted with them before, and you probably guessed, since they're both late 80s movies, or the first one was early 80s, that they're probably problematic. Mm. Yeah. Then there's the 2016, which we talked about. Mm-hmm. So I'm very curious what you think of a modern Ghostbuster set in the continuity of the original, and if they attempt to comment on any of the issues with the earlier entries, all that stuff. I'm just leaving all that up to you to see how good of a job they do.
All right. That's fair. That's fair. Well, then that's it for our show. Our theme music was by Matt May. Horror Nerds Merch releases every Thursday. Please comment, rate, and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Support us on Patreon and get access to exclusive movie commentary episodes, BooTube episodes, and more bonus content by going to patreon.com/horrornerdsatchurch. It starts at just $5 to sign up, which is cheaper than the therapy needed from the PTSD from surviving war, particularly.
Jeez, yes.
Follow us on social media, Facebook and Instagram at Horror Nerds at Church, and Twitter at HNEPOD for all the updates about upcoming film news and other announcements. Until next time, don't let that gold weigh you down.
And check your cisterns for dead bodies before you drink out of them.
Uh-huh. And Abel had something that, like, made us both go, ooh, but... I don't remember.
Anyway, yay, bye.